twin forearm bones moved, the rapier grasped in bony fingers closing over an ugly wad of fat where the palm should have been. Her hair and skin were colourless. That pallid face brightened to see me.
"Harrow," she said.
Harrow, she was genuinely delighted to see you. The smile on that thin white face was real.
"Harry, you're..."
I moved closer and totally fucking ruined her day.
"Alive, bitch," I said.
That expression hardened like it had been dropped in quickset concrete. In the gloom, her face was a pale floating blotch with shadowed features. I couldn't imagine the eyes, but I knew they wouldn't be hers. She had long since ascended to the rank of double douchebag. Ianthe flicked a lock of goose-stained hair over her shoulder, leaned against the kitchen wall and said, "Oh, you."
"Nona Jesimus, I'm sorry.
I was averagely good all my life, at least not criminally bad. I did a bunch of shit I'm not proud of. Some of it I regret, some of it I don't. I absolutely regret not kicking Crux down a flight of stairs and watching him go, "Oof, ow, my bones!" down each step, which, now that I think about it, does not help the case I am making here. I wasn't absolute garbage. Maybe you'd agree. But when I saw that tall, hot glass of skank and heard her diffident, "Oh, you," like she'd never faked your fucking face, like she couldn't see a corpse that was obviously there, like she'd never messed you up or messed around with you, like she'd never seen you vulnerable and smacked her pallid, mummified lips, like she'd never put her hands on you, never made you want her, and never imagined there'd ever be a reckoning. There would be a goddamn reckoning. Nona Jesimus, I was going to wreck her. I said, "Do you want your ass kicked now, or do you want your ass kicked later? Or both?"
"Please, let's address this like gentlewomen," said Ianthe, without much hope.
"Hell no! I'm going to pull your whole ass off," I said. "You want that? You want Harrow to grow you a new ass bone where I pulled off the old one? Let's dance, Tridentarius."
"This can't be happening. She's not even into you, okay? It's just the bones. She's into bones. One of the many aspects I possess that you now tragically lack."
"Get down here," I insisted. "Fight me."
Perhaps I should have guessed that the moment your footstep cursed this universe again, you would issue me these comedy challenges, she said wearily.
"What was your name again?
Goblin?
Gonad?
Help me out here."
"Your cavalier knew my name," I said. "Corona knew my name. You know my name."
She fell silent.
I said, "Gonad was pretty good. Mildly amusing."
"Thanks.
Goblin wasn't."
"I haven't had a good day. I'm very stressed right now. Give me a break."
"You have 3 minutes of me being reasonable, and then I'm going to beat you so badly that you look like a fourth house flag," I said, and lowered my sword.
"Is it over? Did you do the thing? You know, fight the whatever."
"The resurrection beast," she said. "No, if you must know. We engaged it for a while. Mercy Morton went AWOL. Nobody expected that. Then Harrowheart dropped. We had expected that, though I'd hoped. Things got difficult. After Augustine dropped out, I was not about to stay down there with a 2-person team. That creature is large. I surfaced, and here I am, and here you are."
"If you're talking about the sour-faced donkey's ass with the net," I said.
"Yes, mercy," said Ianthe instantly.
"She put a sword through Nona Jesimus's back. Last I saw, she was thrashing around in a puddle."
That white face in the darkness sharpened. I heard her indrawn breath.
"You're certain that Mercy tried to kill Harrow," she said, after a moment.
"Yeah.
But that doesn't... Why would she..."
"Do not fucking ask me for information. I could not be more lost right now."
"Help me down, Ninth," she demanded. "I cannot walk on these things without succumbing to a strong desire to scream and loose my bladder. And we have to talk, you and I."
I kicked a path for her, rolling some of the bees clear with your arms, shouldering them out of the way until a thin aisle was cleared for Ianthe to walk through, shuddering all the while. When we made it out into the hallway, she took a few moments, leaning against the wall, framed against the unbelievably tacky bone decor. All the skeletons in their little outfits and the mummified busts in niches and the fanned-out rings of arms holding jewels or swords or whatever. That place was like a party where everyone was dead. She froze when we heard that infernal buzzing from down the corridor. It was followed by a shout. "Stay here," I said.
"Get fucked," she said thickly. I absolutely did not become the eighth saint to serve the King Undying so Gideon Nav could play hero for me.
Why did you ascend to be a lictor?
Ultimate power and posters of my face.
Fair. The end of the corridor opened into a wider hallway, obviously meant to showcase that same King Undying's every grotty little trophy. The hall was lined with pillars of bone sweating in the heat. Runnels of moisture trickled down the pale carvings, and I readied my sword. But I was too late. The bees were already dead. They were strung up neatly from the ceilings in strangling nets of tendon, squeezed to death, thick streams of green slime dripping from their bodies all over the black and white tiles. Some of the lamps had been smashed in the chaos, and even now swung dangerously from the ceiling, strobing over these hideous parcels. A figure stood in the hallway, breathing hard into the crook of his elbow. He hadn't even drawn his rapier, though somebody obviously had at some point, as piles of dead bees lay in the corner segmented neatly. It was the lictor you called the Saint of Patience, alive and unhurt, apart from a gleam of sweat and blood on those snobby aristocratic features. I was struck again by how almost unreal lictors always looked, or like they were more real than anyone else was, more present, painted in more saturated colours. He kept running one hand over his flat, combed-back cap of fair greyish hair, and looked as though he was thinking seriously about power chundering. When he saw us standing in the doorway, he approached and snapped, "Chick, we have to get back in there. Gideon hasn't surfaced, so he's fighting the damn thing alone. Help me find your elder sister."
"Wait, Harrow?"
His surprise shifted almost immediately to distracted annoyance. "For the Emperor's sake, Harrow Hark, if you lived, could you not at least have dropped in to assist?" But he had stopped dead. And he was looking at us. At your face. He looked at my eyes in your face in the same way the other lictor had, and any colour in his own drained straight away. I've seen a lot of things in my time. Swords, pictures of ladies who lost their clothes in an accident, a bunch of corpses, eclectic maybe, though now I think about it, maybe not the widest variety. But I have never seen anyone look at anything the way those lictors looked at us. Mercymorn looked at us like we were the picture in the dictionary next to unhappiness. Augustine looked at us like we were the last thing he'd ever see.
"John," he breathed, and "Joy." And then he fucking legged it.
When I turned us around to look at her, Ianthe was watching us with cautious, half-suspicious curiosity. She never did show all her cards. It was pretty shitty the way she towered over you, over a head above your height, a bleached and charmless reed of a human. She'd never seemed that tall back at Canaan House, but I wasn't used to your eyeline.
"Mystery on mystery," was all she said, and then, "How I hate seeing you in her face."
"You've got 2 short minutes left before I punch you right in the butthole," I said.
"Follow me. We haven't got much time, quite apart from your hurtful threats of sexual violence," she said. "Why, your fist is so big and my butthole is so small."
"Just move, Tridentarius. I'm not ready to laugh at your goddamn jokes."
she took us, gagging every time we got too close to an oozing, sagging space bee corpse, which was a much more comfortable way to laugh at her than watching her mocking mouth form the word butthole to her amazing golden white room. I was almost too stressed and distracted to appreciate that awe-inspiring painting of the banging cavalier holding a melon, with her necromancer friend standing on a plinth while the wind blew leaves to hide his junk. That was art. Completely worth dying for, just to see for myself. "Hurry up, I have a letter for you," said Ianthe. "Harrow, it was in your handwriting." She handed me a fat, bulging envelope with your handwriting, and it said, "To be given to Gideon Nav," and I felt strange. Time softened as I held it, and I didn't even care about the barely repressed, mirthful scorn on the other girl's face. It was your curt, aggravated handwriting, curter and more aggravated than ever, like you'd written it in a hurry. I'd gotten so many letters in that handwriting, calling me names or bossing me around. You'd touched that letter, and I... You know it was killing me twice that you weren't there, right? You must know it was destroying me to be there in your body, trying to keep your thumbs on, and I couldn't even hear your damn voice. I peeled open the envelope. You'd sealed it up tight. Though I was pretty sure that Tridentarius had busted it open in between. She was just that type. And found a little piece of flimsy with the edges still ragged from where you'd torn it. The letter was wrapped around a black, folded-up bunch of angles. Smoked glass, thin black frames, mirrored lenses. A little bend in one arm, but otherwise you'd kept my sunglasses. I slid them on your face immediately. They were a little too big for you. They kept sliding down your nose. I had to bend the hooks behind your ears to make them stay. With my eyes safely hidden, I opened the paper, and it just said one thing. Four stupid goddamn words. No dry, nonagesimus explanation, no instructions, no commandments. In a way, I would have killed for one of your lists of rules about exactly how to treat your body, how I was going to have to take showers with all your clothes on, which, by the way, I'd already planned on doing. But I almost knew what you'd written already, so I don't know why I was surprised. One flesh, one end. Which did not make me happy, Harrow. It did not fill my heart with soft and sentimental yearning. You set me up. You set all of it up. I gave you one damn job, and instead you rolled a rock over me and turned your back. I spent all that time drowning and surfacing in you over and over and over, and all because in the end you could not bear to do the one thing I asked you to do. I wanted you to use me, you malign, double-crossing, corpse-obsessed bag of bones, you broken, used-up shithead. I wanted you to live and not die, you imaginary girlfriend-having asshole. Fuck one flesh, one end, Harrow. I already gave my flesh to you, and I already gave you my end. I gave you my sword. I gave you myself. I did it while knowing I'd do it all again, without hesitation, because all I ever wanted you to do was eat me. Which is, coincidentally, what your mother said to me last night. She is such a romantic, drawled Ianthe. I crumpled the flimsy and crammed it in your pocket. Tridentarius, I said, and I had to take a breath to stop myself from hewing her in half. Then I said, if you keep acting like you know her, not even like you care about her, but like you know the first thing about her, I will end you here and now. Everything you did to her, you did because she was alone. You thought nobody gave a shit about Harrow Hark, Nona Jesimus. You played with her because you thought it was funny. But she never gave you anything. You never got anywhere. Naberius's eyes narrowed. I hated those eyes and that face. I kept expecting to smell hair gel. Ianthe sat down on the bed with her long, skinny legs crossed at the knee, that waxen face just one more memorial on this goddamned floating funeral, and she remarked, "Did you? What are you talking about?" "I am talking about forgetting, you big-mouthed warrior nunlet," she said, and examined her fingernails, and levered a glob of dried-up green from her thumb with a brief flash of nausea. "Good God! Try taking Coronabeth's memories from me. I'd kill you myself." "Love, don't make that face, child. I have loved plenty. True love is acquisitive. If you keep anything, strands of hair, an envelope they might have licked, a note saying good morning, simply because they wrote it to you. Love is a revenant, Gideon Nav, and it accumulates love stuff to itself because it is homeless otherwise. I'm not saying she didn't care about you. One does care about one's cavalier. It can't be helped. But I watched Harry rearrange her brain so that she could empty herself of you. I laughed right in her face. "Oh, shit," I said, once I'd stopped, because it was weird to hear you giggle that much. "Sorry. It was pretty funny." "You think you can make me jealous? You think anything I did has been to make her love me?" "You don't know. She didn't even tell you." Her face didn't flicker. The wan features were schooled into a look bright and interested, but those oily, brown-pebbled eyes were like a snake's. "Enlighten me," she said. "Hang on. I don't want to let this pass by. Harry." "I thought it was cute. Elucidate, Gideon. We really don't have all day." "Like I said before, she's just not into you. She's into bones. She gave her heart to a corpse when she was 10 years old, I said. "She's in love with the refrigerated museum piece in the locked tomb. You should have seen the look she had on when she told me about this ice lolly bimbo. I knew the moment I saw it. I never made her look like that. She can't love me, even if I'd wanted her to. She can't love you. She can't even try." She said, way too carefully, "Oh, please," as though... But I cut her off. "Don't start the I was toying with her mwahaha noise, because I won't believe it. Your plan backfired, Tridentarius. You've got the sickness. I know the signs of nonagesimitis. You were all lined up for a big hot injection of vitamin H." Ianthe scrubbed at her forehead briefly with her bone hand. "Really? A corpse?" she said, with not totally believable carelessness. "She wants the D," I said, "and the D stands for dead, and... sorry." "I think I need a drink," said Ianthe, and she murmured to herself, "All that fuss about the saint of duty. What a little hypocrite." "Don't think this means you get more than the teeny-weeniest smidge of pity from me," I added. "If you think anything I did to make her love me, then you don't know anything about her and me. I'm her cavalier, dipshit. I'd kill for her. I'd die for her. I did die for her. I'd do anything she needed, anything at all, before she even knew she needed it. I'm her sword, you pasty-faced, Coronabeth-looking knock-off." "Always your sword, my umbral sovereign. In life, in death, in anything beyond life or death that they want to throw at thee and me. I died knowing you'd hate me for dying. But Nonagesimus, you hating me always meant more than anyone else in this hot and stupid universe loving me. At least I'd had your full attention." Ianthe was chewing pettishly on a lock of that bone-yellow hair. I added, "I need you to lay off. I was already the worst thing that ever happened to her, and she doesn't need you trying to one-up that, like, bet I can make this double shit." I watched her recross her legs slowly at the knee. She was no longer examining her nails. She looked at me with a searching, almost studious expression, pale lashes down over her dead man's eyes. Her biceps weren't bad, actually,
There was definite muscle in her remaining skim milk arm. Nothing to write home about, but she didn't have to be completely ashamed. Unlike you.
You're wrong, you know, she said calmly. It's an interesting revelation. Perhaps it even gives some context. But my attachment to Harry isn't remotely what you think it is. I'm not her cavalier, her servant, or thrall. I am a lictor. Harrow is a lictor, and the centuries will entangle us whether she wants them to, or... Nev, if you persist in making jack-off motions when I'm talking, I will show you what Harrow's kidneys look like. That's what I'm talking about, I said. Don't show me her kidneys. Don't think about her kidneys. Don't do anything with her goddamn kidneys. Get a grip. Don't look at her blood or lick her bones or do any of the shit necromancers lie and say they don't do the moment two of them get nasty. She shrugged that gold-skinned shoulder. What can I say? She said. I love a little gall on gall. Reverse everything I just told you, I said. Let's get married. Ah, the romance I have been waiting all my life, she said pleasantly. Babs always said it would come along, or at least he once said I would go to hell and get fucked, which I took as a roundabout way of expressing the same thing. That's all I had to give you, Gideon. Now we are going to get out of my bedroom, and I am going to take you to teach her. The Emperor of the Nine Houses, the Necrolord Prime. I said, no thanks, I'm good. He needs to know. He can help you.
I might lie down and see if this fixes itself, I suggested. Do you want Harrowhark to reclaim rightful ownership of her body or not? She asked reasonably. She knew I couldn't argue with that, and when she looked at my face she added, this is your chance, Gideon. If you want to help her, this is the only way. And for the third stab, I will remind you that a resurrection beast is descending on us, on her, as we speak. If you'd come back, maybe I wouldn't have ended up following Ianthe Tridentarius to see God. But you didn't. You were gone. Might have been a good thing in this instance, honestly. I still didn't know if you were going to kick my ass for that conversation, or if you would be sorry for me. I knew which one would have been worse.
Chapter 49
I am the Emperor's hand. Do not thou persist in this combat. Matchless am I with the long blade.
Ortus Nigenad's voice reverberated around that ice-rimed, organ-swagged facility like one of the sleeper's gunshots. The great body, the one that Harrowhark had in her crueler youth assumed would look best once the man was dead and his bones settled in the family monument, proved to possess a pair of lungs that could declaim to wake the dead. Abigail's voice rose with his, though hers was desperate and somewhat wild.
Nigenad, you think too much of me.
Never, lady. Matchless alike in my magecraft. Fall to your knees and be glad that I spare thee. Thy courage is mighty.
Book 5. Harrowhark's least favourite.
Oh, God, she heard Abigail say. God, please help me.
Heavy, booted steps approached the coffin. Harrow dared not poke her head around its bulk, and anyway, she knew what she would see. Instead, she scattered a fistful of crushed ash in a wide half-circle around herself and Ortus, and raised it into a jagged wall of calvarial bone, 6 feet high and an inch thick, the toughest and thickest posterior parietal she could manage in her pre-lictoral state. The shell absorbed some of the force of Ortus's declamation, rendering it flatter and less thunderous, but it was still impressively resonant as he continued,
"Mightier yet is thy folly, if thou think'st yet to oppose me." The lictor spoke and was silent.
The bone fence shattered. It was impossible. Harrow now clearly remembered the wall of bone she had summoned up around herself, Gideon and Camilla Hecht, in those dreadful final moments on the garden terrace. She had been almost spent, and yet her barrier had held off a determined onslaught by one of the Emperor's fists and gestures for at least a minute. Kithareia had been 10,000 years old and heir to limitless necromantic power. The sleeper had a baggy orange suit and a gun collection. Yet now she shouldered her way through Harrow's wall with irritable, disgusted motions, as if it were an unexpected curtain of cobweb in a catacomb archway. The bone barely even seemed to break. It simply flaked away in chunks, like old plaster from a ceiling. The sleeper forced her upper body through the crumbling wreckage, gun thrust out before her, and shot Ortus in the belly. Ortus reflexively clutched at the wound, and everything went very still. He took his bloody hand away and stared at it as though awed. Harrow looked from the hole in his abdomen, small and neat as though drilled there, to his face, and then to the sleeper, still wedged halfway through that absurd torn rift in what should have been solid bone. The gun sent up a curl of smoke, and that has-covered face revealed nothing. Her cavalier cleared his throat again and said, faltering, working that huge, resonant bellow,
"Nonius, wound!"
He had to swallow.
"Nonius, wounded!"
But he managed no more. Harrowhark's heart crumpled like foil. She latched on to the ripped edges of her wall and drove outward, hard, hurling the sleeper backward off her feet and through the air. The shattered lumps of debris she spun upward into constructs. So easy, even now, easy since she'd been a child. 1, 2, 3, 4 clattering skeletons flinging themselves onto the attacker to rip and wrench with fleshless hands. The sleeper was on her feet to meet them. She shot the first through the skull, and the whole body resolved into ash, which was not how it worked. Did the same to the second. The third managed to lay hold of her free arm before it got a bullet through its spinal column and crumbled into garbage. Harrow's ears pounded, and her head throbbed, and her skin felt wet, and she dragged up 4 more to follow them. She did not know why Ortus had to go mad now, but when the 9th house advanced, its reverend daughter would advance with it. She roared, her voice not so much a ringing trumpet as it was a howling alarm.
"Nonius wounded full sore, spat blood and gave him a grim smile, nor did the sword in his hand shake."
From behind her, Ortus said weakly,
"Harrow."
Boldly he answered the saint, "'Tis true that—"
And there she hesitated. Nonius's responses were generally where she began to think about anything else in the whole universe. She became aware that Abigail was chanting. Her voice did not betray any fear, nor sense of desperation. The words melted together like wax beading on an edge of a candle, sublimating into pale liquid, resolving into beads that stuck midway down the taper. Harrow caught her plea, distracted.
"When I come into my homeland, my family will sacrifice in their halls for you, the best of all our blood, the freshest, the best of all our blood, the oldest."
As Harrow floundered, Ortus whispered,
"Your power is great."
She continued hastily,
"Your power is great, O servant of masterful Canaan, nor may I hope to be counted your equal in skill, nor in craft, nor even in bodily vigour."
The sleeper smashed a last skeleton into powder with a blow from her gloved fist that looked almost dismissive. "It's over," she said, and aimed the gun at Harrow's head. The candles burst forth in chrysanthemum flames of blue, fully 6 feet high. Time seemed to gel, and Harrow, hands outflung, watched the bones she had scattered pause in midair like falling white stars. The fire wailed upward.
She swept her gaze across the room. There lay Magnus and Dias and Protesilaus, still where they had been felled. There was Dulcy Septimus, propping herself up in a doorway with wide and violent eyes. And there was... Abigail Pent blazed like a flare from a blue and alien sun. Long prominences of light trailed from her fingers. It seemed as though she held in her hands a book with all the pages fleshed from that same azure radiation. Amid that frantic cold, Harrow saw that Abigail was soaking wet, wreathed in hot mist-like shimmers by spirit magic. She had thrust off her jacket and her mittens and stood there in just a dress and her robe and bare arms. A reek hit Harrow like a faceful of snow, water, brine, blood. A multitude of voices lifted up in Abigail's and screamed. Glutinous time unglued. There was a crack as the sleeper fired and a sharp metal spang, and nothing hit Harrow in the head. A shadow rose before her, and it was all the shadows of the room. The candles were no longer columns of great blue light, but had sunk to billowing black flames. She was frozen by the sound of a great bell. Blablang, blablang, blablang. The first bell of Driaber, of the House of the Ninth, sounded loudly in that laboratory atrium, and a figure stood between Harrow and the sleeper. The figure wore a cuirass of black laminate that had not been favoured by the cohort for years and years. Fibre armour, matte and unpolished, shadowy, rather than shining obsidian, with small overlapping plates layered across its surface. The rest of the armour was more timeless, black canvas breeches tucked into black greaves of leather and plex, and the stiff, unpretentious frieze hood of Driaber, not worn up, but loose on the neck. Worn-out black polymer mitts, no more sophisticated than griddles. In one of those gloved hands was a rapier of lightless black metal with a plain guard and hilt, though from that hilt clanked delicate rows of knuckle-bone prayer beads, terminating in what was unmistakably, even by candlelight, a carving of the jawless skull. In the other hand was a simple black metal dagger, its blade thrust out horizontally a few feet in front of Harrow's face, where it had blocked the sleeper's bullet mid-flight. The new arrival turned its head to look from the sleeper to Harrow. In those black and spitting flames, what she could see of the face was quite ordinary. Dark, Driaber hair, cut fairly short but not sacramentally shorn. The skull paint was cursory in the extreme, a few lines painted along the bottom jaw and chin, the merest suggestion of teeth and mandible. The flames guttered around Abigail Pent. She looked terrified, uplifted, and openly astonished. She looked far away, as though she were no longer even truly with them. Her spectacles had slipped off her nose, and in that blazing blue corona her eyes were dark and liquid and feral. The House of the Fifth always skinned itself over with such airs of civilization, with so many manners and niceties. But they were spirit talkers, and speakers to the dead, and the dead were savage. The sleeper stepped away and lowered her gun. "Ninth was my name," said the new arrival. "Ninth was my hearth and my homeland. Here have I come at your calling. None may return from the river unless he be bidden by bloodright. Tell me, why have I been drawn here?" And Abigail said, "I speak your name, Matthias Nonius, Cavalier of the Ninth House. I charge you to protect the reverend daughter of Driaber, and to slay her enemies." "Waste not your breath," said the ghost of Matthias Nonius. "Such was my task when I lived. Why now in my death would I need a reminder?" Harrowhark said, mostly to herself,
Oh, God.
As the newcomer spoke, he had circled very slightly to the right, away from Harrow. The sleeper had kept her gun trained on him the whole time, cautiously, as though waiting to see what he would do. Now she fired, and Nonius moved. In one long, liquid evolution, he seemed to flatten and extend himself. His whole body became a single smooth device for deploying his rapier's blade, like a needle flicking out of a spring housing. The point bit into one orange flank, and the sleeper stumbled backward. From this new tear, Harrow saw dark liquid trickle. Nonius's body folded back into place somehow, his rapier held with the hilt low and the tip pointing up at his opponent's face. He resumed his slow circular drift. "A tool for a killer of beasts," he said. "What warrior wields such a weapon in honorable service of combat? Has dignity wholly departed the houses since I saw the starlight? Or are you some raider or cutthroat?"
"You're just a ghost like the rest of them," said the sleeper.
But this time the flat voice that emanated from the hazmask carried a tinge of disbelief.
"You don't get special rules."
"In life I was only a man," the ghost agreed. "But the ninth house granted me honor and made me unworthy its servant. I speak with the voice of the tomb, and my strength is the strength of the Black Gate. Why am I talking in meter?"
The sleeper fired twice, but the sword flicked up diagonally across Nonius's body, hilt at his face, before Harrow had even heard the shots. One bullet ricocheted off into the darkness. The other seemed to hit the armor, and Nonius jerked slightly with the impact. But again, the blade shot out so fast and sure that the movement hardly made sense to the eye. The sleeper sounded a muffled curse through the face mask and dropped her weapon, which clattered on the tiles. Then she snatched back her hand and brought it out from behind her back, holding a significantly longer and fatter gun. This one had a blunt, squat barrel that even to Harrow's untrained eye looked like bad news. The sleeper braced it in both hands against her shoulder, pointed at Nonius's face.
"Go back to hell," she said, and pulled the trigger.
There was a flat metallic snap, and nothing happened. She pulled again. Nothing. She threw the gun to the side, and before it had even hit the floor, it had been replaced with a long, elegant rifle. This yielded a hollow clunk, and a distinct lack of anything else. The sleeper backed away a few more steps, her plex mask as impassive as ever. Nonius followed, not closing the distance, but matching it, echoing her movements.
"You ought to look after them better," he suggested.
"I killed wizards' filth like you all my life," snarled the sleeper.
This time the object that appeared in her hand was not a gun. It was some sort of fat cylinder. She flicked it downward, and a slim black baton, perhaps 3 feet in length, telescoped suddenly outward with a noise like a bolt going home.
"I killed them with guns and bombs and knives and gas, and when I didn't have any of those, I just got in real close and put my thumbs through their fucking eyes. You can flick that little skewer around all you like, boy. I'll choke you with it."
"I certainly hope you're a fighter," said Nonius, and raised his dagger hand. "God knows you're not a debater."
They both lunged forward at once. As the first crack of plex on metal sounded, Harrow dropped next to Ortus. She grasped him with her hands and with a pair of skeletal arms for good measure and started to haul him to safety. He did not help. He was too busy watching. Much like Abigail, he was transported, not to some kind of ancestral state of primeval ghost worship, but to a wide-eyed heaven only he understood. She had never seen Ortus look triumphant. She had never seen Ortus in the eye of any storm of his own making. She said urgently,
"What did you do?"
"Oh, I did nothing," he said breathlessly. "Pent Pent is a marvel. I will write songs for Pent.
Write them later, and hurry up now.
If I die my final death here, he said, I will die knowing the only happiness that I have ever known.
Oh, shut up and move, she said desperately. If all of her cavaliers were this excited for death, she was definitely the problem. He did not move. He was smiling.
You were part of the miracle, Harrowhawk. Your emphasis was almost perfect.
He smiles grimly at least 20 times in that act alone, Nigenad, she snapped. Find a new collocation. It turned out that a relatively small amount of Thanagy was all she needed to staunch the blood from his wound. His major organ function was stable enough, whatever that meant exactly, where a ghost was concerned, and she didn't want to mess around with complex tissue repair in these circumstances. Harrow's early training had taken place in freezing, poorly lit crypts, and still this particular crypt seemed unhelpfully dark and unmanageably cold. Having propped Ortus against a wall a safe distance from the action, she turned to see what had happened to the others. The surviving necromancers and cavaliers, whom she had to remind herself were here precisely because they had not survived, were arranged silently around the room's perimeter. Abigail was sitting on the floor, still a coruscating blue flame, and her husband had his arm around her and was leaning heavily into her with a face taut with pain. Neither of them watched with any particular joy, but with a hungry intent, a cold anticipation. Dulcinea and Protesilaus had crawled to each other, leaving long snail trails of blood behind them, to meet exhausted at a point in the middle. Only the lieutenant had managed to stand, with the stiff-backed and impassive precision of a woman on a parade ground watching a drill. She looked as though at any moment she might blow a whistle for halt. Harrow suspected a whistle would not be enough to halt this particular duel. It was like nothing she had ever seen at Canaan House, not even like the practice bouts on the Mithraeum, which had been inhumanly fast and skillful, but somehow bloodless, more dances than fights. These were two people who had spent their lives doing nothing but fighting, now freed from the shackles of flesh and time, focusing their entire selves on the business of murdering each other. If Gideon had been there... No. If Gideon had been there, Harrow still couldn't have hoped for a running commentary. Griddle didn't know how to do running commentary. She would suck her breath through her teeth or mutter in ecstasy words that meant nothing to anyone who wasn't her, things like, right foot, in tones that suggested that if she died on the spot, that right foot would have somehow been the apex of her existence. Nor could she ever explain a fight after the fact in terms that Harrow could understand. But if her cavalier had been there, Harrow was fairly sure that she would have sucked her molars out of their sockets from sheer intensity of feeling. Gideon, watching this single combat, might have better appreciated the anonymous monster called the Sleeper for what she truly was. In life, she must have had few, if any, equals. Her people, whoever they had been, must have cherished her as their finest champion. She was a prodigious fighter, fast, brutal, ruthless in exploiting advantages, terrifying in her force and aggression. She had gained a wicked-looking knife with a serrated edge in her left hand, balancing the baton in her right, and she struck with it at eyes, groin, or anywhere else she could reach. The heavy haz suit did not seem to slow her at all, and she had a cat-like agility in keeping with her earlier handspring. She kept swerving her body away from strikes and mixing elbow jabs, knee strikes, and even kicks into her overall assault. There was no trace in her of the beribboned show fighter. She fought like she wanted to kill you, and she hoped it would hurt. And her opponent was Matthias Nonius. 1,000 years ago, Dreaber had produced Matthias Nonius. He had not become Cavalier Primary until very late. More correctly,
He should have been Matthias the Ninth.
But Harrowhark had never heard anyone refer to him that way. He had never been described to her as anything other than the greatest swordsman of our house. He was rather short of stature, arms averagely long. Neither of those was correct, surely. Ortis had always given the impression he was perhaps 7 feet tall and 3 feet wide. Nonius's ghost had emerged from the fog of legend, looking more like a meek priest than a warrior, but with the sword in his hand, a black, prayer-wreathed blade of her house, and his off-hand knife in the other, the type of simple black blade carried by chaplains or nuns. He was a poem. He was absurdly still, which he thought was against the rules of all rapier swordplay. He stood lightly in place, feet positioned hips-width apart, and the sleeper would pummel at him, take that black cosh and whip it cruelly at his ribs, gouge that long knife upward toward his inner thigh. And no blow would land. Nonius calmly parried them away as though he'd studied a list of the moves to come. It did not even seem to take him effort to block the lightning action of the knife, or of the club, or of the kick. He just stood there, with the black candle flame gleaming off ebony steel, and made himself a barricade. And then he would move. He had lift Harrowhark had never seen in a human being, as though gravity changed its rules for him. His movements were never hasty or choppy. He would give all he had to one beautiful fall of the sword, and the sleeper would begin to bleed. There were fully half a dozen slits torn in her suit now, and all of them were smeared with red. But she neither stopped nor slowed, and gradually it was wearing him down. Nonius always did wear down in long fights. From books 1 to 4, he was matchless. His enemies died if he looked at them. But later, Ortis had seen fit to add long specific duels between his god and a few named and honourable rivals. If a foe got a hit in on Nonius, it was a good indicator that they would be present for at least the next 10 pages, even if half of that was talking. The sleeper smashed her baton down on Nonius's skull with enough force to stave it in. Nonius stepped clear and kicked her in the outside of the knee, sending her stumbling for balance, and took the opportunity to lash a clean line down her thigh with his rapier's tip. Blood spattered the floor. As he slid back into guard, Harrow saw that his clothes had changed. The bright orange haz-suit had somehow become a suit of fibre duelling armour, much like Nonius's own, with a padded cuirass sporting several blood-stained gashes and a set of plex amalgam greaves. The ensemble was still the same warning orange colour, which produced a very strange effect. The blank hood, with its faceplate, was now a peculiar curved mask of what looked like deep gold, wrought in stylized likeness of a proud face with a beaked nose and slitted holes for eyes. Only the knife and baton remained unaltered. Bewildered, she looked up to find the room was changing too. The nine-sided structure was the same, doorways in every wall and the great coffin at the centre. But the doorways were now arched and ceremonial, rather than squared off and industrial. The dark metal panels had become dark stone blocks of a familiar type, although the floor, with its ring of candles and the remains of its diagram, was still of metal tile patched with frost. Some of the fleshy webbing clung on the walls, but in places it had vanished, along with the signs it had covered. In the corner between two arches, there now hung a single ragged black banner, emblazoned in white with the jawless skull. It was no specific hall on Dreaber that Harrow had ever set foot in, but it was unmistakably a room of the Ninth House. By our very presence in the river, we briefly exert space on non-space. The struggle for control backstage is leaking over into the action out front. She had been once again so slow. The sleeper had found herself unable to use her firearms because there weren't any firearms in the Noniad. Ortus disdained them. Even the nameless enemy soldiers Nonius faced were always described as wielding spears or clubs, just as the force of the sleeper's hatred had translated into unreasonable strength against Harrow's necromancy, the power to smash through solid walls and turn constructs into dust with her bare hands. Now the force of Nonius's devotion to the Ninth, refracted through the prism of Ortus's accursed poem, was overwriting the sleeper's rules. Even the wounds, she realized with a start, were correct. Whenever Nonius faced a serious opponent, both parties always ended up running with blood from a series of largely cosmetic wounds. In one pivotal duel in Book 9, Nonius and a rival cavalier fought for a full hour, both bleeding heavily the entire time, and at the end simply shook hands and exchanged epigrams on valour, rather than jointly passing out from hypervolemic shock. The sleeper had seized control of Harrow's staged memory, the story her brain was telling itself about Kanan House, and used it to prosecute her guerrilla war against the Nine Houses. Now Matthias Nonius, or at least Ortus Nigenad's version of Matthias Nonius, was trying to turn it into an epic poem. He was not altogether succeeding. The space was in flux. As Harrow watched, the floor beneath her feet began shimmering into close-set slabs of black lacquered stone, but the slabs faded like mist almost as soon as they appeared, and the metal tiles returned. The sleeper whipped her baton into the side of Nonius's face, sending him staggering, and followed up with a vicious knife thrust to his belly. He turned it with the thick part of his blade, but awkwardly, and the sleeper managed to knee him in the flank and score the knife's point down his sword arm for good measure before he shoved her away and fell back into guard. They paused, breathing hard. Blood showed plainly on the bizarre orange armour, blooming in startling curls and petals. Less so on the black dribber leathers, but the floor around Nonius's feet was spattered red. The sleeper's golden mask remained smooth and perfect, whereas Nonius had gained a gash down his cheek and a split lip. "Few have I fought so ferocious. To match you in arms is to stand against fully 100 unworthy," he said, which was exactly the kind of thing he was supposed to say. "You're good, but you're just another fucking zombie," she said, which wasn't. The voice still sounded husky and blurred, even without the Hazsuit mouthpiece. "Who was your master in life? Whose banner and blade did you bear?" he asked. Nonius always displayed an unhealthy curiosity about the people trying to kill him. "What mission compels you to face me?" "My master in life was revenge," said the sleeper. "My mission is one of..." "God damn it! I'm not going to start talking like this." "Enter the river with pride," he said, and there was something genuinely sad in his voice. "Go back to its turbulent waters. Fain would I spare such a fighter." She rushed him, low and fast. The baton rang against his sword, and she struck upward with her knife, as if to impale his throat. But she flipped the blade somehow in her hand as it came, so his parry with the dagger caught empty air. The butt of her knife struck him under the chin, snapping his head back. A long, slender filigree of blood sprayed from his mouth and hung in the air for what seemed like half a second too long. Even as he fell back, his failed parry flexed in the space between them and flicked past her ribs, the dagger's tip trailing a thin and perfect arc of red. Across the room, beyond the duel, Harrow saw Dulcie Septimus trying to limp out the doorway. Her cavalier, who had propped himself upright against its frame, shot out an arm and pulled her back, sparking indignant outrage on her face. He glanced at Ortus, and they gave each other a grim, soldierly little nod of understanding. Harrow murmured, "Septimus has the right idea. If I raise a construct now, close in on the sleeper from behind, Dias wasn't badly hurt, and she still has her sword.
Lonius doesn't fight in a crowd,
Ortus said tightly. Nigenad, you do realize this is not literally a poem.
You saw what happened to the guns, he said. Rules are everything here, Harrowhark. If we break them, I am certain we are lost.
Harrow gnawed her lip. The more ragged and brutal the fight became, the more it seemed to favor the sleeper. Nonius could not get the space to bring his rapier properly to bear. He was increasingly holding it against his body, using it more like a shield than the scalpel she knew it was meant to be. The floor between the fighters was one great smear of blood in which their feet skidded for purchase. As Harrow watched, Nonius did something clever with his dagger, and one of the sleeper's strikes flew wide. She lost her footing for a moment, and he took the opportunity to step back, free the sword, turn it for a thrust. She brought the baton down on the inside of his elbow with all the graceless force of a butcher chopping meat. Nonius cried out, and the black rapier of Dreaber fell from nerveless fingers and clanged to the floor. She stepped in close, drew her head back, and smashed her golden mask into his unprotected face with a dreadful crunch. He reeled backward and half fell against the empty coffin, his newly free hand coming up to his eyes. The sleeper advanced, her mask's impassive gaze twisted into a sneer by fresh blood. "Fancy footwork, shitbird," she said, and raised the knife. Matthias Nonius came off the coffin like the Emperor's wrath. He crashed into her bodily, driving her back, and then swung his knife at her exposed side. She blocked it with the baton, and he kneed her in the gut, grabbed the back of her head in his empty hand, and kneed her again in the throat. They grappled. Harrow could hear her coughing wetly through the mask, and she managed to shoulder him away. But he came straight back in with a knife slash that nearly unstitched her guts. Harrow caught a glimpse of his face, now mostly blood. His nose was broken, and his lips and chin were wet with gore. There was blood in his eyes and under his hair, and his expression was one of cold and perfect murder. It was as though losing the rapier had snapped some invisible shackle. He didn't even look angry. He looked like an ending given human form. The sleeper struck out with the baton. He grabbed her arm, twisted, and brought his elbow's point down hard. The arm snapped wetly. Then he caught her by the back of the neck like he was pulling her in for a kiss, and jammed his dagger into her belly. She dropped her knife, which joined her baton on the tiles, and seized his throat with both hands. He drove her all the way back against the wall, and they wrestled there for a second. Then he broke free of her hold and stumbled clear, leaving the black dagger's hilt protruding obscenely from the orange fabric at her gut. As she grasped it with her hand and tried to pull it free, Protesilaus VII left his doorway and came forward a few steps. He had detached his sheathed sword from its belt, and he flung out his arm and sailed the whole thing through the air. Nonius caught the exquisitely patterned scabbard in one bloodied hand. He drew the lovely sword of the rose unblown, and as the sleeper dragged herself off the wall, brandishing the dagger, which steamed with her blood, he ran his blade through her heart. He skewered the sleeper up to the hilt, and as she fell, jerking, he slid down to the ground with her, supporting her with his other arm. Only when the sleeper stopped moving did he withdraw the sword with a silken wet whisper. The candles flared with a last burst of black flame, and then sank to a glimmer. All around them, there were sounds like sausages flung from a height as the draped tubes and ligaments fell to the ground, bouncing damply before dissolving into pinkish powder. The icicles fell one by one, slush before they hit the tiles. There was a humming noise and a plink, and the electric lights in the ceiling came suddenly on, pouring down blank white light, the unkindness of hot filament. Harrowheart crossed over and crouched down next to the ghost swordsman of her house as he gently prized the mask from the sleeper's face. The features were slack now. They were smeared with blood from nose and mouth, but not otherwise obscured by damage. A bound-back mass of hair had been tucked into the collar, but some strands and wisps had escaped and plastered themselves in red whorls on the forehead and cheeks. That dead, proud, unforgiving face beheld them all until Nonius closed the sightless eyes, and Harrowhark was bewildered. She did not understand. The blue flames no longer licked at Abigail's palms and skirts. She kneeled on the hard metal grill, careless of discomfort, and she asked, "Harrow, do you know her?" The sleeper had the unmistakable face of the portrait in the shuttle on the planet she had killed. The woman plastered behind Corona and Judith, the familiar woman with the pitiless eyes, had fought to usurp Harrowhark's soul. "Not at all," she said. Nonius pushed himself to stand. He wiped the borrowed sword on his thigh, turning the blade this way and that, then presented it to Protesilaus, who was either supporting Dulcie or being supported by her. It wasn't clear, and it was ridiculous either way. "'Tis dirtier than it deserves," he said. "Such a blade would I sooner return with better than blood, and my best thanks." Protesilaus said, "I wish that my whole house knew of my privilege. If I lived again, I would advise all the Seventh to travel to Dreber if they sought instruction in the art. If I had but 5 minutes of life again, I would spend them praising you. I would speak of nothing but my reverence for you and the Ninth House and its nonpareil swordplay."
"I'd call that a waste of 5 minutes," muttered his necromancer, sotto voce.
Harrowhark's cavalier was smirking with barely concealed glee.
"My lady," Nonius said.
He had turned toward her. He neatly bowed. She bowed back and said,
"I hope that your bones are blessed in the Anastasian for your service."
"My bones fell far from home," said the cavalier with a faint smile. "Never, I think, will a wanderer happen upon where they now lie, far though he travel. 'Tis blessing enough that I see such a reverend daughter, and know that my house stands stalwart and dauntless, proud in the face of its foes. But I still don't know why I'm talking in meter."
Ortus was saying to Abigail,
"Lady, it's you who should be praised. Your act of necromancy should reverberate through the Nine Houses like the dying refrain of a song. I would that I were still alive, so that I could complete my great work and begin the next one afresh, and call it the Pentiad, and perhaps alternate between 5-foot and 9-foot verses, a total departure from my first work, but reflective of it. I would make you the poem, Lady Abigail, that you already are."
"I did ask you to stop flirting with my wife," said Magnus, and at Ortis's face said instantly, "Joke, man, joke! Do they not have them on the ninth? That would explain a lot."
"Ortus," Abigail said gravely. This was the first time Harrow had ever seen her even slightly disarrayed. Her hair, normally brushed to mirror smoothness, looked as though she had been dragged backward through the os. She was wet with sweat. She kept rubbing her hands discreetly, and Harrow saw that they were singed.
"Ortus, it should not have worked. We had no right to call the soul of Matthias Nonius. Your sword had no viable link to him. We had no thanagetic connection. We had nothing but the manuscript you gave me, in which I took the liberty of correcting a few spellings. I hope you don't mind."
Harrowhark was certain Pent had no idea how terribly she had just wounded Ortis's gratitude to her. Looking at the brief, stricken expression that crossed his face, it would perhaps have been kinder to make him eat the book. I find myself in the astonishing position of having created a revenant link through, well, sheer passion.
That revenant turned to Ortus now. Standing together, Ortus towered head and shoulders above him.
Harrow expected that same stricken horror to show on her cavalier's face, but as Ortus looked at the ghost he had spent his whole life worshipping, yet another thing she and he had in common, he flushed deeply.
"I am unworthy," he said simply.
"Clearly that cannot be true," said Matthias Nonius. "If the fifth speaks aright, if your art was the anchor that rendered me whole here, and gave me a body and blade for the battle, your art, not my strength, was the ultimate source of our victory."
Harrow looked away. From far off in the facility, there were more sounds, of melting ice, of snapping viscera. She found her layered robes heavy. So were the others, and they shed coats and gloves even as she watched. The air felt lighter. That reeking fog had gone. As she unwound lengths of fabric from around her neck, she found herself drawn back